Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Are we doing this? Really?
Wait for it.
Are we doing this?
Wait for it.
Pow!
What the fuck?
WTF.
And it's also, what the fuck?
What's wrong with me? It's time for WTF.
What the fuck?
With Mark Maron.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck sticks? What the fuck nicks? What the fucksters? What the fuck rakers? How about that? How about that? This is Mark Maron. You're listening to WTF. This is my podcast. Hey, Craig Gass is on the show. Craig Gass, known for his work on the Howard Stern Show, and also known for one of the, I think, probably the best Sam Kennison impression in the business, if that means anything to yous, which it does to me, and also has a hell of a story. He'll be here later. He'll be here. He'll be just ahead, just minutes ahead. On your machine, on your equipment. He's here later on your equipment, just minutes ahead. Thank you all for all the amazing feedback on the new season of Maron on IFC. I appreciate you watching it. I'm very proud of it. And as I've told you before, it's a little tricky for me to be proud. And it's hard for me to buttress criticism. There hasn't been a lot of criticism, but it's interesting to me that almost every episode of the new season, someone will say, like, this is the best episode yet. And then some other idiot will go, well, this one wasn't that great. And I start to realize that a lot of criticism is not criticism at all. It's very tricky to support it with some logic or intelligence. It took a long time for me to realize a lot of criticism is not unlike projecting. They're just projecting their shitty life onto you, you know, in order to make a point. Why does something strike somebody one way and something strikes somebody so completely different? Well, obviously, the random factor there is they're both individuals bringing their own truckload of garbage to the table. And how do we arrange that garbage? And what garbage in me does this trigger? Now, obviously, I'm referring to garbage as the bad things. The good things are just ice cream and cotton candy and jelly beans. So if you're bringing ice cream, cotton candy, jelly beans, and maybe some patchouli to the table, that's different. You can organize that however you'd like. But if you're bringing just a big truckload of garbage, like you're just a garbage barge floating through your personal ocean of self, lost, where does this garbage go? Well, I think I'll dump some of it on Maron's show. Even though I dumped jelly beans and cotton candy and ice cream on it last week, this one deserves some garbage. And I think I'm going to dig around a little bit to the bottom of this barge and find the oldest garbage I can find, because that seems to be what's being irritated. Here you go. Here's some garbage from my past on the table. And that's my criticism. Bleh. I'm not saying I prefer cotton candy, ice cream, and jelly beans, but, you know, it's funner. So I did some things this weekend. I did some things this weekend because I had a friend in from out of town. Pow! Look out. Just shit my pants. JustCoffee.coop, available at WTFpod.com. I've been dating somebody and a bit, and it started in Texas, and then it became, then we Skyped, and then she came out for a couple days, a couple weeks ago, and we had a nice weekend, and then we Skyped. And then she came out for a couple of days this weekend, and we do things. That's the interesting thing. When you have someone in from out of town, you realize, holy fuck, I don't do anything in the city I live in. Nothing. I do nothing. Do I go to shows? No. Do I go to museums? Not really. Do I go to tourist attractions? Nah. So she comes into town, and I want to talk about this, the interesting thing I found about the future and the future we're living in. For a period of time there, when we were Skyping almost every night, you spend more time talking without distraction or weirdness when you're actually not there. You're actually just on the computers together, just talking. And I found that, like, wow, this is a serious boundary. This is a modern boundary. For a while there, we were categorizing it as a sad future movie, but it's sort of a real boundary. It enables you to actually have a conversation and then, you know, kind of go away. But anyways, she came to town and we went to the movies. We went to Venice Beach. I haven't been to Venice Beach in a while. I wanted an ice cream. I wanted a soft serve ice cream. I wanted to go to Venice Beach. And I'd forgotten what's amazing about Venice Beach. It's like, it's not like a beach anywhere else. It's not like a beach in Florida or Hawaii or even in Texas. Venice Beach is some sort of strange, multi-ethnic, global clusterfuck of weirdness. The beautiful thing about Venice is it's just packed out with people of all kinds, not giving a fuck what they look like, and some people pushing the edge of not giving a fuck of what they look like. Some people being complete full-on freaks. A lot of things for sale. Hey, would you like a sage bundle? How about a shitty painting? How about a henna for your face? Hey, look, here's another shitty painting. How about some of these? This is my big idea about sculpture. How about one of those? You want one of those? How about an ice cream? Yeah, I have an ice cream. And then we walked on the beach, and there's those moments where you're like, well, this is it, man. This is the big payoff. This is what we're doing. This is what makes life worthwhile, to be able to walk on the beach without too many worries unless I make them happen. That's the interesting thing about me, if you want to call it interesting, is that even when I'm walking on the beach, if my mind has any free time, even though it's beautiful out and I can see Malibu in the distance and I'm with somebody I like and I'm just walking on the beach, my brain will go like, fuck, what's wrong with my computer? How does that play into it? Fuck, what's wrong with my computer? How come my backup drives aren't showing up in my Finder? Dude, you're on the beach. Look, you see infinity. You see the horizon line. You see where it just falls off the edge of the earth. You see the one thing that's been provided us by the universe that's supposed to be a calming influence and sort of spread your shit out in your brain, kind of make it float for a while or go away. Look at that. Look at the sailboat. Fuck. I got to call Jeremy over at MacMan. Dude, look at the beach. No, maybe I should text Jeremy at MacMan now. Dude, relax. No, it's nice. I mean, I like it and everything, but I don't understand my computer. So I'm walking on the beach and we're doing things. And I'm just sticking my head in stores. Like I got, you know, I don't even like this, necessarily like the stores. On Fairfax Boulevard here in Los Angeles, there seems to be like 9 or 10 stores that only sell skateboards and baseball hats of different kinds. There's literally 5 stores there, skateboards and baseball hats and skate t-shirts. But I'm still sort of fascinated with that for some reason. I like hats. I would never wear a hat, but I want to see the hat. It was like looking in galleries. So I just, as we were walking down Fairfax, I'm sticking my head into places. And she's like, you're weird. I'm like, why? And she's like, well, you just stick your head in. You're just sort of like, you know, hi, I don't really want to come in. I just, you know, I want to just kind of judge and just, you know, not engage, but just stick my head in. And, well, yeah, I mean, that's what I do. And I go, well, why do you think I was weird? And she goes, well, yeah, because, you know, I said, what's the difference between me and you? She goes, I have boundaries. And you're like, I have questions. And that really is the sort of difference, the questions over boundaries. If I go into a restaurant and I see something I like, you know, I'm going to be that guy. I'm going to be that old Jew. I've always been that guy. It took me a while to jump that line. I mean, you can pull the server aside and go, what's that person eating? Or if they're close enough, you can go like, what is that? What is that you're eating? And it's such like an old Jewish lady thing to do. But I, you know, maybe I'm an old Jewish lady. You know, like, what's that you're eating? Is it good? Is it good? It's nice. You like it? I don't know. Maybe I'll get that. Maybe I'll get one of those. Uh-huh. And I'm that guy. I don't have boundaries. I have questions. And that's what I learned from my weekend. All right, my friends. All right. I've done enough. Things are fine. I'm happy. My show is on Thursdays. I'm going to share with you now my conversation with Craig Gass.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Yes. So you walk into a morning show and you're like, what do you guys, who do you like having on? And they go, we love, Michael Winslow. We love Michael Winslow. You know who really kills there? Pablo Francisco. We like Pablo. We like him.
Well, you know whose name comes up, and it really blows me away, the amount of preparation that he has. Brian Regan,
yeah,
not only pays attention to what he does on somebody's morning show, he has a notebook that he travels with, and he makes a note in every city that he goes to.
What bits he did
on what show.
Right.
And so when he comes back,
to make sure he does new bits,
he doesn't repeat it.
Well, I mean, that's he's a professional.
Yeah.
I mean, that guy is, because I, as you know, a lot of times local morning radio is what's going to determine whether you get people.
Yeah, that's where the business is.
Right. Even with Twitter and with everything else, it's still like, if you kill it, you have a chance of bringing in people that have no idea who the fuck you are.
Yeah.
That are just driving and they're laughing. They're like, oh, I'm going to go see that guy.
And you always hear from people after the shows when they come by to say hi, they go, man, a couple days ago, I heard you and I was like, I don't know who the fuck this guy is.
Yeah.
But honey, we got to buy tickets.
Right. And they come.
Yeah. And it's changed a lot because radio and content in radio has gotten tighter and tighter in terrestrial radio.
And less and less reach.
Less and less reach because people are turning to satellite radio, podcasts. I was going to say podcasts, satellite radio,
yeah,
their iPod.
Yeah.
And so there's less and less of an audience out there. But it's still, I like getting up in the morning and going out and...
I like going to do morning radio sometimes. I mean, I sort of dread it, but if the... if the crew is good, it can be a good time. I mean, there's some guys you're kind of happy to see when you go out there.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and it's there's some people who want to see if they can fuck with you a little bit when you come in. And that's fun, too.
Is it?
Yeah, of course. Well, I mean, because I've been working with guys who fuck with people for years, you know? Yeah. Like
Howard?
Like Howard, and, you know, and it's... So I'm okay to roll with it. I don't take myself that seriously. I think it's a lesson you learn. Is not take yourself that seriously.
Oh, you've never gotten pissed off over something that you've never been sandbagged.
No.
Oh, that's good.
Because as soon as they start insulting me, I have enough humility to step back and go, you know what? I don't even like me either. So, it's, you know.
But do you generally just snap into a voice?
No. It depends on what kind of radio it is. Like Top 40 radio, I'll go in and I'll do... voices, because that's what they like to hear.
Yeah.
If I go into a rock station where I'm more comfortable,
yeah,
I'll tell stories about the people who we all listen to that I've managed to have some really embarrassing moments with. And
like who?
Like Gene Simmons.
Yeah.
From Kiss, who I do an impression of on the Howard Stern show. Every time we had a music guest in the studio,
yeah,
I would constantly interrupt them as Gene Simmons,
yeah,
and try to sell them shitty Kiss products,
yeah,
which was just like a goofy thing. And like we'd have like everyone from like Coldplay to big rappers to Paul McCartney.
Uh-huh.
And in the middle of their interviews, I would interrupt them and start jumping in with Gene Simmons saying, you know, if you go to kissonline.com right now, we can show you with a pie chart how the Beatles stole everything from Kiss. And Paul McCartney look at me and go, who the fuck are you?
Yeah, because you know. You're on the radio, but you're still sitting there and you've got to bust balls on the genius.
Yeah. That's like, I did a show. You ever had people come out to your show? I actually have a story like this with you, where you have somebody come out and they're watching you perform and you really respect them. And so you want to do really well,
yeah.
And then you don't, and then you remember, like, that guy probably hates me now.
Did we have tension, me and you?
I walked up to you at the Boston Comedy Club, and I go, Mark Maron? And you go, yeah. And I go, hey, my name's Craig Gass. I'm a comedian. I'm going on a little bit after you. Do you mind sticking around and watching? You're like, yeah, sure. And I think I even told you, I go, I do an impression of Sam Kinison.
Yeah.
And you go, well, yeah, sure. And I'm like, oh, my God, Mark Maron's here. Mark Maron's here. And I decided that well, Mark's not just going to like any stupid voice. I got to go up and do something hardcore. And I had an idea that I'd never tried on stage before.
Yeah.
And I thought, that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
I'm going to go up and go fucking over the edge.
Yeah.
And Mark's going to be like, man, this guy's got balls. Yeah. And I ate my nuts.
Yeah.
For like 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And respectfully, you sat there the whole time watching me eat.
But you closed
shit.
With Sam, right?
I think I did close with Sam.
Because yeah. I remember hearing the first time I heard Sam, the first time I heard you do Sam, I'm like, holy fuck, that's too creepy.
Yeah, that Sam, your relationship with Sam, I never knew him.
And... Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, to me, like, it probably at that point, I was like, probably give me bad flashbacks to actually yeah. hear. It's really about the way he talked.
You know, it's funny that you say that, because in L.A., when I do Sam on stage, people don't, they especially when I do it at the Comedy Store, they don't go like, what? Like, there's always like a, Jesus Christ. Like, people just kind of feel weird about it.
Well, yeah. Well, oh, you mean like the people that work there and
yeah,
stuff?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that place is haunted with him, and I wonder how, I mean, I guess a lot of people remember him. I don't think he really gets a fair shake in terms of... the guys that that should be remembered. I think he sort of outlived his thing in a way, even though he died young. He became sort of pathetic towards the end.
Yeah.
And I don't think people really remember him as the amazing comic that he was. That first record, dude. That first fucking record is crazy.
Yeah, and there's guys who at the Comedy Store will come up to me and say, hey, I got a story for you, and the stories are fucking...
out there.
Insane. There was a guy that used to play piano there named Kelly Moran.
Yeah, I remember Kelly.
Kelly came up and said... I got a great story for you. Sam and I were at a party one night.
Yeah.
And Sam had a mirror piled high with coke. And Sam was talking to me, and not intentionally, but he passed the coke to a woman behind him who was 8 months pregnant. And everyone goes, Sam, what are you doing? And he goes, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, man. It's not intentional. I didn't fucking, you know. Everyone goes, Sam, she's giving birth next month. And he goes, well, yeah, well, that, and, you know, plus you don't want the kid coming out next month going, where's the dealer's pager? Oh, oh! And he goes, the next day, I'm with Sam.
How do you do that? It's too close.
He said, the next day, I'm with Sam. Yeah. We're driving over the Hollywood Hills.
Yeah.
And Kelly says to Sam, dude, remember that moment last night where he tried to hand the coke to that girl that was pregnant? Sam's voice completely, or his face completely blank. And he goes, remember the girl, she was pregnant, and you tried to give her the coke? And then, and what was the line you said? You said, oh, you had a great line. You said, plus you don't want the kid coming out going, where's the dealer's pager? And he said, Sam just looked at him and went, oh, did I say that? I'm going to write that down. I'm doing that on stage tonight. That's a great bet. Yeah.
It's that fucking weird cadence. Because he really talked like that. Like it's not so much the screaming part, which people can do, but you've got the whole the cadence of that weird accent he has.
That voice where you go, wait a second. Wait a second. Yeah. Where's my sponsor? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I always had, and I don't know if you know this, so I'm just going to...
Well, your Gene Simmons is pretty solid, too, man. I mean, like that he sounds like an old Jew, and it's weird that what I find with Impressionists is that if they're really good, they'll make me notice something about the person they're doing where you can actually, because I think your brain naturally does that. In order to do an efficient impression, I think you find what characterizes them, through their voice. And a lot of people who just see the person are not going to notice that stuff. But when someone does an impression of him, like there's some kid who's got some YouTubes up of him doing Louis, you know, with a bald wig and everything else, like Louis doing classic jokes. And it's him doing Louis on stage. He does it okay, but I never noticed, you know, how deliberate Louis's cadence was and how sort of strangely... some of it is rooted in Woody Allen. I wouldn't have noticed it just from knowing Louis because I'm too close to Louis. Yeah. But when I see someone do an impression, I'm like, oh, that really is. He does do that.
Yeah. Sometimes somebody will do an impression where they don't, it's not strong.
Right.
But they exaggerate one thing that you go, shit, yeah. That guy does do that a lot. Somebody...
Well, as somebody who does impressions, when you see a bad impression, I mean, because I think like a lot of times bad impressions are marked by the fact that they overhit a thing.
Right. But sometimes it that becomes, that still resonates so huge that that becomes the standard to go by. Like Dana Carvey has impressions that he's done of George Bush and of Regis Philbin that to this day, people kind of go from Dana Carvey out. They they start with, you know, not going to do it, not going to do it, to, you know, and then and build out from that. Or from Regis, it's Dana's Regis that people start with.
But but that sort of rip, that's not really doing your own work in a way.
Yeah, it's true. And
who do you think the best impressionist was?
Well, there's some impressions that are amazing. Frank Caliendo's John Madden impression is flawless. And I love hearing great impressions. It's like beautiful music to me. And you know who does great impressions?
Who?
Norm MacDonald.
Oh, yeah?
Norm MacDonald does an impression of, and I love random impressions.
Yeah.
Super Dave Osborne.
Uh-huh.
Norm MacDonald does an impression of Super Dave Osborne. And I think he even does an impression of Mitch. Because I remember Mitch told me that that Norm did an impression of him. And but I've always been able to do any kind of voice that I hear because of how I grew up. My entire family is deaf.
Wait, now, so what do you mean your entire family?
My mom, my dad, my sister.
They're all deaf.
They're all deaf.
Congenital deafness.
My mom was born congenitally. She was born completely
deaf. I've only talked to one other person that has this.
That whose family's deaf? Is it a comic?
Yeah.
Is it?
Moshe.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Moshe Kasher's parents were not only Hasidic or Orthodox, but they were deaf as well. But he didn't become an impressionist, though. But he does, his laughter is really loud and deliberate.
Wow.
I don't know what it must be like. So what kind of household was it? Did they meet each other at deaf school?
Yeah, my mom was born completely deaf from a birth defect. Mm-hmm. My dad was born with all of his hearing and then lost it when he was a kid. He got into an accident that popped out his eardrums.
Oh, my God.
And so he had to go to deaf schools.
That's horrible.
For the rest of his life.
Yeah.
Where he met my mom at an all-deaf high school. They fell in love, got married, had my sister first. My sister's born with my mom's genes completely deaf. And then I'm born with my dad's genes with all my hearing.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I just over-explained that, but...
No. But I mean, what was it like? I can't imagine what that would be like. I mean, in the sense of like, when did you first realize it? How did you learn how to talk initially?
Well, I just learned sign language, and it wasn't until
late. But you're a child. Mm-hmm. At some point, someone has to walk you through the English language and to talk. Who taught you how to talk?
Well, that's where TV came in, and I started mimicking all the voices.
No,
on
I
TV,
get that, but before
and,
that,
and my grandparents lived in the same building, so my grandparents. So it was like a mixture of signing and speaking and signing and speaking. So
but your grandparents taught you how to talk.
Yeah, it was my grandparents and watching TV, watching a lot of TV, and but it didn't seem unusual to me until, you know, I guess it never really seemed unusual to me, except, you know, people would go like, wow, that's unusual.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in New York, outside the Bronx in Mount Vernon.
Okay, so you grew up there, up at the top of the island there.
It's like 10 miles from Yankee Stadium.
Right. And you grew up in an apartment building and your grandparents were upstairs. And these were whose parents? Your mother's or your father's?
My mother's parents were upstairs.
Okay. So they brought up a deaf child. So they knew how to sign and they knew all the, so you were the first child that they actually were able to kind of raise to speak.
Yes. Yeah.
Was it a bunch of Jews? Are you Jewish?
Yeah, I'm Jewish. Yeah. But my mom was, even though she's Jewish, we'd celebrate Christmas every year.
So yeah, they like the lights, right?
Yeah, the Hanukkah and the tree. And the tree.
Get a tree. I had a little of that. At times there were trees.
Yeah, I always enjoy being able to dip into both holidays.
Yeah, why not? Yeah. So, all right, so there you are. You're growing up in the Mount Vernon. Your parents are deaf. And so signing is second nature to you.
Yeah, it's although I spell everything out, almost everything.
Oh, so you're not hip to the new symbols.
I
that
don't
get added later.
Yeah, I started doing fucked up symbols, and my mom never corrected me because she understood what I was saying. So she never. So whenever I see deaf people in distress, I always like to help.
Yeah.
I always like to come up and go, and I'll start signing.
Has this happened to you?
Yeah. Well, like deaf people trying to communicate officers, and I'll walk in and go, hey, I know sign language. Okay. And I'll go, hi, I know sign language. And I'll be able to, and I'll sign it to them, and they'll go, oh, and they'll start signing really fast. And I'll go, hold on. What? Yeah, I don't understand. Yeah. Go back. Can you spell it? Can you, S T, wait, can you bet S? No, can you start again? S T.
Oh, because some like have. Well, my question is, since you learned sign, have they updated? I imagine they update symbols, like they tighten it up at some point.
Well, there's kind of like a regional thing around the country.
Get out of here. There's like regional sign language. There's kind of accents.
Accents, exactly.
Stop, really?
Yeah. And like around the world, there's different signs for different words.
Uh-huh.
And
that must be confusing.
Yeah. The best was, I don't know where I was. I saw, I had a TV on in a hotel room, and I saw the funeral going on in South Africa
uh-huh.
for Mandela. And I see this guy signing, and I thought, and I'm watching him for a second. I go, well, it doesn't make any sense to me, but maybe it's different in South Africa. It wasn't until later that I found out the guy was clinically insane.
Yeah.
And none of his signs made any sense to any deaf people.
Yeah, yeah.
But and that was hilarious to me. Some of the best deaf jokes I've ever heard were from deaf people.
What are they?
My sister took her out to dinner a couple weeks ago, and she said, she signed to me, do you want to hear a good joke? And I said, yeah. And she goes, me too. And I was like, oh, that's great. And she goes, it's, you know, it's whatever. She kind of waved it off like, it's kind of hacky. And I was like, hacky? That's awesome. You know? And it's funny to me that people want to be protective of people with handicaps.
Yeah.
Yet people with handicaps are making jokes about their handicaps.
That is an interesting thing. I think that on some level, that it's sort of like some sort of guilt, you know, that people diminish the handicapped person's entire identity by protecting them preemptively or you know, thinking that they know. I mean, they've got to have a sense of humor about it.
Of course.
And they've got to, you know, there's a certain pride in it after a certain point, I would imagine.
Yeah, there is something about laughter getting you through things that people don't understand. They want to be protective and say, well, you know, these people need protection. Nobody needs protection.
Or that you need to be polite in a way that you wouldn't necessarily be polite, you know, in deference to them.
Yeah.
Which I think is condescending and a little demeaning.
I agree.
But, you know, we're not always the greatest judge of sensitivity, comics. I mean, if we were, I think we're all very sensitive, but it's hard to know, man.
I think we're all sensitive, but I think even someone like Brian Regan can tell you a really fucked up joke. I remember Brian Regan, on ONA, they pointed out, you know, Brian, the thing about you is you're hilarious, but you never curse. And he said, no, I do say motherfucker in one of my jokes. And they said, you do? And he said, yeah, it's a joke about butterflies. And it's like, you know, it's goofy, but it's like everyone, I think comedians have sensitivity, but it's very strange. I think things have changed in the last 10 years, especially with Twitter, because everyone has a voice and everyone can contact you and go, you know, you suck, or that's not cool. You can't say that. Dare you?
Yeah, there's more of an immediate, you know, cultural dialogue about offenses. You know what I mean? It's still up to the comedian. You know, if you want to fight the fight, you fight the fight. No one's denying you the right to do that.
Have you ever gotten exhausted for fighting the fight on a thought that you either did on a radio show or on stage? Have you ever had to fight to where you just thought, it's too much?
Yeah, over the retard.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't so much a fight, but, you know, I had to really weigh it out. You know, the question you have to ask yourself is, what's it worth? What's the point you're trying to make? Are you just saying something because you can say it? Are you saying something to provoke a reaction? Or are you honestly think that it's a, you know, it's an important joke? And my joke was really about the word retard. And what it used to mean to us, and what it's grown to mean to that community, is that, you know, I like the angle was, you know, I would never call a retard,
right?
you know, but
that's beautiful.
Well, yeah, but it's wrong. But like it's wrong minded, because the truth is that I think mostly it's a family of people who are I don't even know what the proper word is for people that were once called retarded, intellectually challenged or whatever it is, mentally challenged. But, you know, it hurts them. So is it really worth it, you know, to do it? But, you know, that word is like, it was so part of the culture, but that doesn't mean it's right. You know, it's like the word tranny now. It's tricky, man.
Tranny's offensive to people?
Yeah.
It's the first I'm hearing of that.
It's offensive to the transgender community. See, once the what you're talking about is true, that once these channels of communication are open and public and more accessible, is that communities that may have been overlooked or gotten short shrift or not identified as communities now have a voice. So transgender people find tranny to be insulting.
But they'll call each other trannies.
Well, maybe. I don't know.
Black people call each other the N-word.
Well, I mean, I don't know if they all do that. I mean, occasionally I'll call a Jew a filthy Jew or a Jew bastard or, but I don't do it often.
I just feel like that you can say anything as long as you make a strong argument for it. And
if you want to make the argument.
If you want to make the argument. And yeah, it can be exhausting. You can, from the jump with that word...
Have you had the problem before?
Yeah, with me, I mean, it's like, I don't think I go into anything on stage that's that controversial. I just, I like to just be silly.
Yeah, well, when did you start? So you say that the knack for impressions started from actually gravitating towards speech in general because of the environment you grew up in.
Mm-hmm.
So when do you identify, were they originally... cartoon characters?
No, it would be like just people who I really admired and watched a lot of would get stuck in my head, like Muhammad Ali, the Fonz.
Oh, really?
Yeah, guys. And then over time, I would always just...
How old are you?
I'm 40. I just turned 44.
Okay.
And over time, I just had this knack for like picking up weird voices, and I never got an accent.
When did you realize that? I mean, when did you start using it to your advantage, so to speak?
From the time I was like 4 or 5 years old, I would do impressions for my family who are deaf, but the impressions but the impressions didn't involve voices. They would involve just
mannerisms.
Yeah, mannerisms. I would just do like, all right, here's grandpa.
Oh, so you do
waiting. So I would do and every time I do an impression, I never think of the voice. I think of the person.
Yeah.
Like Tracy Morgan kind of looks spacing and just, hey, man, that's crazy. I like you. You're very sexy. That's crazy. Adam Sandler doesn't look you in the eye, and he's likes to, tell silly duty jokes. And or Al Pacino, who will look you right in the eye. This guy. Why does this guy never avert his eyes?
Yeah.
I never think of the voice. I think of like the way they are as a person.
Yeah, well, I have had that moment where, I used to be able to do about a second of Dustin Hoffman.
Really?
And like, well, but I can only do it reflexively, like in a moment. If I think about it too much, it won't happen. So you have to think about it and then register it into your sense memory so you can repeat it.
Yeah, I never, and I'm very lazy. So it's either right there,
yeah,
and it sticks with me, or...
have you lost some?
No, I haven't done Sam in a while until I just did it earlier in this conversation, but it's usually just kind of stuck in there somewhere. I just picture the person. Or when I tell stories about people, like Mitch Hedberg was my first roommate in New York, and when I tell stories about living with Mitch, the voice will come back and it'll just be right there.
Oh, really?
And when I first moved in,
he couldn't look you in the eye either.
Yeah, that kind of bummed me out. He's
moving from side to side.
Yeah, my first day in Mitch's apartment, I put my stuff down and I'm trying to get my bearings straight. And he's telling me a million, because he's going to leave and I'm going to have the apartment to myself that first weekend. And so he's telling me where everything is in the neighborhood. And then he goes, hey, Craig, this is a map of the New York City subway. And on the back of his front door was this huge map of the New York City subway, which... the first time you look at it, it's very intimidating. There's a lot of yellow and blue and red lines going every direction. Yeah. So I'm staring at the map and he goes, so that's how that works. And then he walked away and I was like, what the fuck?
How'd you meet Mitch? What year was that?
I met Mitch.
I remember when he moved to New York.
I met him in 95 in Seattle. I opened for him in probably 94, 95. There were guys that would come to town. Like you, Patton Oswalt, and Mitch Hedberg, the people would go, oh, you got to watch these guys, these guys. And so I would always try to campaign not even knowing anything about those people, I go, can I open that show? They're supposed to be an amazing comedian. I want to open that show.
You lived in Seattle?
I live in Seattle. That's where my career started, was in Seattle in 1993. I started at the Comedy Underground.
The original one.
The original one.
Yeah, it was a good room, man.
I was there for a year.
How the fuck did you end up there, man?
I had friends who had moved up to Seattle.
So you were in New York. You wanted to start doing comedy.
I was in New York, first 10 years of my life in New York. Then I moved to Arizona, where all my formative years were, where I started doing drugs. Was in Arizona.
Did you go to college there?
I didn't even finish high school. And I went to high school for a long time. I went to high school for 5 years. I still don't have
in the Bronx?
In Tucson, Arizona.
Did your family move there?
Yeah, my family moved there because they have a good school for the deaf in Tucson, Arizona.
For your sister?
Yeah, for my sister.
So you started doing stand-up in Tucson?
Yeah, my first couple open mics was in Tucson. Then I moved to Seattle with no idea of how great of a comedy scene there was in Seattle. I just moved to Seattle because some friends of mine had moved to Seattle, and I wanted to be a stand-up comedian. I thought I was funny. I thought I could, that I was funny enough to try it.
Well, what were you doing in Tucson when you say you were doing drugs? You didn't finish high school? How is that possible?
I can't pay attention to save my life.
So what do you mean? How far did you get in high school?
I had a couple senior years, and I never got my diploma, but I went on two senior trips. Yeah. I go to the high school reunions for each of my senior years. I attend all my reunions for each of my senior. I know it's. I enjoyed the social aspect of going to school.
So people were happy to see you. You weren't some sort of wallflower. They all knew you as the guy that went two senior years.
Which, by the way, is one of the reasons why I feel like I don't relate to a lot of comedians. I love people. I love being around people.
Now, wait a minute. I mean, you know, some of them do, right?
I feel like a lot of comedians are introverts and
they like hanging around with comedians.
Yeah, they like hanging around with other comedians. Yeah. And but socially, a lot of comedians are not, you know, as enjoyable to be around as you would think.
Well, I think that a lot of comedians think like they... what I noticed recently is that, you know, we have a shorthand about what we can talk about and how we talk about things. And, you know, really, more 90% of the time, if you're hanging around with comics, you're hanging around with brilliant guys.
Yeah.
It's just it's a fact.
Yeah.
And there's quick, there's smart, and they're, you know, and then when you start hanging around with civilians and they're making jokes and stuff, you're like, ugh, all right.
Well, especially when they make jokes along the lines of, I know Jim Norton has made a couple observations about the people who say, like, oh, watch out for this guy. This guy is a real cut up over here. And it's like, you know. But, and by the way, hanging around with other comedians, I think, is the greatest benefit and joy of doing I get to do. I can't believe that I get to hang around these people who I admire so much and get to spend time with. But it was in Arizona that I got a really bad drug habit.
What kind?
Cocaine was really cheap.
Yeah.
Really cheap and really good. It was really pure.
What, 60 bucks a gram?
40 bucks a gram. 40, 50 bucks a gram and pure. Mm. Really, really pure. And so I just started doing tons of coke. I can't. And then I moved to Seattle.
So you're like what, 18, 19 years old?
14 is when I started. 14, and then I moved to Seattle, and then it gets heavier.
What? How old were you when you moved to Seattle?
23.
So for 9 years in Tucson, what did your poor parents do with this fucking drug addled high school dropout who can talk?
Well, like anybody else with drug addicts, you kind of turn the other cheek, and you kind of like
You didn't go to rehab?
Not until I moved to Seattle and I got a job with insurance, and I had this embarrassing moment where I called. I had insurance for the first time. I was working a job that had insurance, and I said, "I have a drug problem."
What was the job?
I worked at GameWorks, mm-hmm. which is like it's a glorified video game arcade.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And but they had this great benefit: if you work here, we'll give you health insurance.
Really?
Yeah. So I got health insurance. It might have been 6 months before the health insurance kicked in, but I had health insurance for the first time. In Seattle.
Was that at a mall?
It's in downtown on 7th and Pike.
Uh-huh.
And I called my insurance, said I have a problem with drugs. And I said, okay, we'll talk to the mental health line. Mental health line picks up, and I said, hey, I got a problem. I'm a drug addict. And they said, okay, where are you at? And I was in this really specific neighborhood. I was in Capitol Hill dating this girl.
I know
girl.
Capitol Hill, yeah.
And they said, you know what? There's a rehab a few blocks from you. And I said, great. And so I called that location. The guy picks up the phone. As soon as he picks up the phone, I know something about the guy. As soon as he picks up the phone, but it's irrelevant. It has nothing to do with the conversation. So I confess all my sins. It's the first
time.
What
do you mean you know something about the guy?
You can tell as soon as he picks up the phone, you already know something about the guy as soon as he picks up. And at the end of the conversation, he says, all right, well, I think we're ready. I do have one more question, Craig. You are a homosexual, right? And I said, I'm a homosexual. Oh. And he said, yeah, you know this rehab is for homosexuals. And I said, I didn't know that. And he said, your insurance didn't tell you? And I said, no, they just said you're the closest one to me. And he said, well, that should be some kind of a note on their screen that we, I mean, we're not gay and lesbian exclusive, but we are gay and lesbian friendly. So yeah. Are you a homosexual? And I said, no. And he said, do you have a problem with homosexuals? And I said, no. And I said, all right, we'll see you on Monday. And I checked into gay rehab and I was there and it was the best place I could have been. I was so fragile. And I was around the most sensitive people I had ever met. And the toughest person in that rehab was a lumberjack chick from Oregon who had choked out her girlfriend in a blackout.
Yeah.
And so I did 6 months of outpatient treatment, and then I moved in with Mitch Hedberg in New York. And I just completely – and I didn't tell Mitch. There was actually a really embarrassing moment when I moved in with Mitch. I'm trying to stay in recovery, and I know that when I get to Mitch, that Mitch doesn't know, and if I want to, yeah. I can just fuck up when I get to Mitch's place.
Right.
And one day, I was out doing something in the city. I came back to the apartment, and Mitch was really I'm sorry, man. I saw some magazines in your bag. I was just grabbing a magazine, man. I'm sorry. I got into your stuff, and I was like, that's fine, man. You can take magazines. And then I noticed that in between the magazines was this AA book. And I was like, ah, oh, man.
Yeah.
And I had already started drinking again by the time I got back to Mitch's place. Yeah. And I was like, ah, fuck.
Yeah.
You know, and I kind of felt embarrassed. And
you felt embarrassed about being sober.
Yeah.
And did he make you feel bad?
Yeah. I mean, it was because when you first realize you have a problem, it's part of the thing you have to go through is and for some reason it's like it's tough to actually admit it that I have a problem. You know, it's like I know something's wrong and I'm fucking my nose is bleeding all the time.
This is in Seattle.
It start from way back. It was, you know, it was fucking up shit. I mean, I can't tell you how many times when I was living in Seattle, this is really embarrassing to admit, but I can't tell you how many times I would start out a date by sending the girl to the comedy club, and I go, hey, just meet me at the comedy club, and because we'll get some free drinks at the comedy club. And it'd be a hot, beautiful girl would show up at the comedy club. I'd hang out with her. We'd drink. We'd start to get to know each other, laughing. And then the door would open, and the fucking Coke dealer, the local neighborhood Pioneer Square Coke dealer, would walk through, and I'd go, fuck. And then my heart would start racing. I go, I'll be right back. Hang on a second. And I go talk to the guy.
Yeah.
I come back. And I can't tell you how many times I did this. I'd walk back to the girl and go, hey, I just realized something. I have to get up tomorrow at 6 a.m. I didn't even realize this. So I got to get out of here. I can't even hang out with you right now. I need to, listen, I'm going to walk you to your car and I'm going to get you. Are you done with your drink? All right, we'll finish your drink and I'm going to get you out of here. I'm sorry. And they look at me like, what are you talking about? I go, I'm going to make it up to you. When's your next day off? Is it Thursday?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'll go out with you on Thursday, but finish your drink. Go ahead and pound that.
Yeah.
And let me walk to your car and let me get you out of here. And I'd walk into their car, give them a kiss. And one out of every five girls would come back to the bar later, an hour, just to see, and I'd be in there.
Jacked
out of my mind and avoiding eye contact, like, oh, shit, they're back, you know. And I can't even tell you how many times I did that.
You're bringing back memories for me. Just the sort of excitement of knowing you're going to get blow.
Yeah.
That was almost better than the blow.
Yeah, and when I found out that there were people at the Comedy Underground that had cocaine, like it was like a year, at least a year or 2 years of doing stand-up at the Comedy Underground before an employee asked me, hey, can you help me with something back here? And I said, help you with what? I don't want you to help me carry a keg. And I'm like, carry a keg? I'm not helping you. And he goes, Craig, just come back here. And I was like, oh man, I don't want to do any manual labor. And I come back and he's got lines cut out on a mirror. And I was like, oh my God. And come to find out that there are people that work here that have it. And I was like, I really, at that moment, thought,
I found my home.
Yeah, home, and I had succeeded. This is the level of success I was looking for.
There's coke around.
There's coke here, and they're willing to share it with me. And I was like, oh my God. And for the next couple of years, I was in complete ecstasy that these people, if I was funny enough that night on stage, that people would just give me drugs and drinks. And
were you doing all impressions?
I think I didn't do impressions at all the first couple of years. I was embarrassed to do impressions because...
You thought it was hacky?
Yeah, because I heard from all the other comedians. All the other comedians were like, oh, this fucking guy. Oh, you know, and I would go, wow, okay, yeah, I guess that's kind of hacky. And there was this feeling that if you do an impression, that you could really just get laughs with no material.
Yeah.
And so I avoided doing impressions for a long time until Ron Reed heard me having conversations with people and said, well, when did you learn how to do these voices? Like, oh, I've always been able to do these voices. And he said, you should do it on stage. I said, it's hacky. I'm not. And he goes, yeah, it doesn't have to be hacky.
Yeah.
If you just do it in a way that's just unique, I mean, you don't have to... Yeah, but just put your own touch to it, but make it conversational like you're doing right now, you know? Just don't make it like, I think it would go a little something like this,
right,
you know?
Right.
And just put your own spin on it. So I started kind of, you know, dipping in a little bit here and there.
Instead of setting it up like that.
Right. And but man, it was drugs, being able to have drugs.
So what's the longest you had sober?
Right now.
Are you sober now?
Yeah, 9 years.
Really?
Well, I had a heart attack, so.
Jesus.
Yeah. I had a heart attack, and then I kept doing coke. I had a heart attack, and...
Oh, maybe we should work up to that. All right, so you're in Seattle, you hit the wall, go into gay rehab.
I go into gay rehab, then I move in with Mitch in New York.
You left Seattle because you didn't want to get sucked back into the blow?
No, I left Seattle because I had started... I was doing stuff on the Howard Stern show. I was
on the phone?
On the phone. I would do...
How'd he find you?
I sent them a tape... with a bunch of voices on it, and the one they zeroed in on was Sam Kinison, and they said, wow, you know, we knew Sam better than anybody, and man, that voice.
Yeah, they can't tell the difference.
Yeah, and they said, yeah, they actually had a meeting about it.
This is after Sam's dead already?
After Sam's dead. They had a meeting about it to try to listen to the tape to hear, like, how did this guy edit a tape of Sam to make it sound like he's talking about current events?
Yeah.
And then they said, man, that Sam impression... We really love the tape. And I said, well, I'd love to work with you guys. And they had an idea for me. So I started calling in. And every time a huge asshole would die, I would put together a piece and I'd call in as Sam Kinison live from the gates of hell.
Yeah.
Welcoming this asshole into the afterlife.
Oh, like who? Like who'd you do?
I remember Jeffrey Dahmer when he died.
Yeah.
And then there were some weird ones. Like I remember when Princess Diana died. I said, you know, this is really sad, but, you know, but thanks to Princess Diana dying, I have the most kick-ass limo driver, this guy. This guy gets me to my gigs on time. He fucking speeds, you know. He's actually going to be the lead driver in the Thanksgiving Day parade in hell.
Yeah.
And it was so out there. And I started writing for the Stern Show. And so once I started writing for the show, I called Mitch and said, hey, do you mind if I move in with you?
And you knew him a little bit, or you'd open for him, or what?
That's the embarrassing thing, is I didn't know him that well at the time.
Yeah.
And Mitch was such a agreeable guy.
What year was that?
1998 is when I moved in with him.
So it was before he really broke big, right before.
While I was living with him, he went on the road, and... I Googled his name one day, and there's all these articles. Mitch Hedberg signs a $500,000 deal with Fox, and I'm in his apartment going, what? $500,000? So we make plans to go to a concert when he gets home. I said, hey, do you want to go see Rob Zombie? He's going to be here the day that you get back. And he's like, yeah, man, that would be a lot of fun. And he ended up getting material that night that the opening act was Monster Magnet. And he used to do a joke about Monster Magnet on stage. So we meet up at this bar across the street from the Letterman show. The concert we're going to go see is at the Roseland Ballroom next to the Letterman show. And I go, how's it going, man? What's new? And he goes, oh, man, you know, same old, you know. And I go, yeah. Hey, I read a thing online that you signed a deal with Fox. And he goes, yeah, man, that's true. And I go, yeah, I also read that you've got... They're paying you $500,000, and he goes, and his reaction was, yeah, man, can you believe they actually print that shit? And I was like, wow, so that's true? And he really wasn't that excited about the money. He's like, my only goal, and I get it now, He said, my only goal is I want to make sure I end up on TV.
Yeah.
I said, yeah, but financially, you don't have to worry about anything anymore. You can just... You can be creative,
yeah.
Not have to worry about working at Ralph's.
He was that way anyways, though, right?
Yeah, he was. he was.
He was going to work at Ralph's, no matter what. All right, so you're writing for the Stern Show. What does that mean when you say you're writing for it? You were doing other stuff besides your bits?
What happened was Jackie Martling and Fred Norris would write my stuff.
Yeah.
And Jackie's style, especially with Sam Kinison, Jackie would write jokes for Sam Kinison that didn't sound like Sam jokes.
Right.
They sounded more like Jackie jokes.
Right.
And I said, hey, do you guys mind if I write? I feel like I have a better idea of what Sam would actually say.
Yeah.
And so I started writing stuff, and they said, oh, this is great. You should start writing for the show. So I thought, well, I should probably move to New York if I'm writing for the show. So I asked Mitch, is it okay if I stay at your place until I find a place? Yes. So I move in with him, and I start writing for Howard. I started writing for Colin Quinn was doing Weekend Update.
Yeah.
I started contributing material to Weekend Update and started hitting all the clubs in New York when I started seeing you.
Yeah.
And I started... Tom Rhodes.
Yeah.
And I started seeing all these great comments. It was really intimidating, and it was a real trip to be around so many great comics. And you know what? I had a really bad idea every time I would actually get a spot on Tuesday night at 12 or 1 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
I was so thrilled to be working at a club in New York, even if it was not getting paid or getting 10 bucks,
right,
that I wanted to show up at 8 o'clock at night and watch the whole night of comedy because I get to perform tonight.
Sure.
And that was horrifying because there's so many great comics in New York that I ended up just being really sad.
Wait, so that's 98?
98, yeah. So it was Bill Burr, Patrice O'Neill.
Yeah, Attell.
Attell.
You doing Attell?
I did a little bit. I did it on a cartoon once, and I can't remember how it went. It was like a, yeah, that's really fun. Yeah. You know,
I do one word a tell impression. What?
Those are my favorites. But so I move in with Mitch, and drug addiction's back on.
So you were, but you'd already started drinking. How long did you stay sober that first round?
A few months.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I made it to 100 days, which was such a big deal to me. Like, wow, I'm sober for 100 days, and. And then I remember when I moved in with Mitch, Mitch took me to a bunch of comedy clubs at night, and he was so awesome. Like, he was trying to introduce me to people.
Yeah.
One guy that was kind of an asshole was Lucian.
Yeah.
I had this funny moment. At the comic strip.
Yeah.
He goes,
I've already got an impression.
He didn't even get that far.
Yeah.
Mitch, really just being polite, said, oh, hey, Lucian. Hey, this is my friend Craig Gass. He just moved here from Seattle. And Lucian looked at me and said, Mitch, you know how we do things here. And he said, no, I'm just saying, this is my friend. Maybe you should shake his hand. And I was like, holy shit. I just felt, I didn't know who Lucian was.
Yeah.
I didn't know what his relationship to the club was. I just felt really uncomfortable. And Mitch was doing me a solid, you know?
That's funny, though. It's just respect.
Yeah, I'm just trying to be fucking polite here. And that night, at the comic strip, Mitch said, hey, man, I'm going to get some drinks. You want something? And I said, yeah. And I looked around. I hadn't drank in a few months. And I said, can I have a Jack and Coke, please? And he goes, yeah, man. And then I was looking around the room like, is someone going to catch me? Is someone going to stop me from drinking?
Yeah, yeah,
and then
yeah.
Mitch walked up to the bar, ordered it, put it in my hand. And I'm still kind of looking around, took my first sip. No whistles went off. Nobody yelled at me. And then I was back on, for another, what was it? 10 years? Yeah.
So now, though, you're going... are you going into the studio with Howard? When did that start?
First, it started with calling in. Then I started writing for the show. And I didn't come in until the day that Jackie had quit. I got a phone call. I got a bunch of phone calls, actually. There was 3 or 4 voicemails on my answer machine. There was a couple messages on my answer machine.
Yeah.
I pushed play, and the first message was, dude, Howard Stern, Jackie Martling just quit the show. They're looking for new comedians. You should call them. Boop.
Right.
Hey, man. Dude, Howard Stern just announced they're looking for comedians. Boop.
Hey, Craig, it's Gary Delabate. Give me a call as soon as you get this. Okay, it's fucking fine.
I call him up, and I say, hey, Gary, I got your message, man. And he goes, hey, Craig, how you been? The first time Gary's ever asked me how I've been.
Yeah.
And I said, I've been great, man. I heard that Jackie quit the show.
Yes, he did.
And I go, is that what this call's about? And he goes,
yes, it is.
And I was like, holy shit. All right. so what do you want me to do? And he said,
we just want you to come in, just kind of see if there's some chemistry, and we'll kind of take it from there, man.
So you'd never been in the studio?
I'd never been in the studio. I've been working for the show, getting paid by the show for 8 years
wow.
at that point, and I'd never been in the studio.
Were they at Sirius yet? When did that start?
This is at K-Rock.
Right, K-Rock.
And then I went in and sat next to Howard.
Yeah.
And
were you freaking out?
You know what? It was kind of like doing it. My goal was the same as doing every radio show, where it was like, I just want the three people in the room to just laugh. That's all I want.
Yeah.
And if you make everyone in the room laugh, then everybody listening will be laughing.
Yeah, yeah.
But my only goal is to make these three people laugh. And I had so much fun. I really only thought it was going to last 2 days. Maybe that's why I didn't feel any pressure for it. I was like, 2 days, finally, I get to come in and it'll be fun.
Yeah.
And that turned into 2 days a week every week for the next 7-8 months.
Uh-huh.
And it turned.
Was Artie there yet?
Artie started coming in, and they would have, by the end of it, I was in every Monday and Tuesday. Artie was in every Thursday and Friday, and Wednesdays they would rotate somebody out on Wednesdays. Uh-huh. And everybody, Chappelle, Doug would come in, Attell,
Stanhope
would come in, Richard Cheney, Kimmel, and. It was mostly known comics.
Yeah, I never went in there. I just did it for the first time last year.
I heard it.
And it was great.
Were you nervous?
I my only nervousness is, what's he got on me? And, you know, what what he had was something I could certainly handle. Like, I didn't know what I think he was going to pull up. Or
I don't remember what it was. What was the thing that he
had?
That
I was an asshole.
Oh.
And I was a jealous asshole. That was what he sort of focused on. But we ended up getting into a pretty serious conversation about, you know, family and fathers and narcissism and this and that. I mean, it was good. I mean, no one chimed in for an hour.
Yeah, it's definitely something where you have that kind of feeling going in, like you prepare, like you're going to the principal's office. Like, I just want to be prepared for this subject to come up.
I just
up.
Didn't know if it would be a conversation or whether he was going to hammer me. And, he, you know, it was a, I don't know why I overthought it. Because I'm not a huge Stern listener. So it was just like meeting a guy on radio. Like, it was only intimidating by name. You know, I didn't have any sort of real idea of what he was going to do. Because I didn't grow up with him, you know.
Did you get a lot of feedback after you did the show?
Yeah, everyone thought it went great. You know, and I think we had a pretty decent conversation. I was happy that he wasn't wearing sunglasses.
Yeah.
You know, and that. It was very relaxed. It wasn't, I enjoy talking to him.
Yeah, he's, the feedback I get every time I do a show is, there's an audience out there listening that you don't realize how huge that audience is. And he gave me my career. I mean, every TV role I've ever gotten, almost every TV role, mm-hmm. has been from people who are fans of his show that are writers for TV shows.
Right.
They say, hey, I got an idea for you. And I still get residual stuff from that, because people who know the stuff that I did with Hal.
But you don't have a relationship with him anymore?
I mean, we still, like, we email each other from time to time. I send him ideas for stuff.
What happened?
I never tried. I never...
Why'd he stop having you on the show?
Well, when they made the decision, they said, we're going to have Artie do the show. Artie's going to be the guy. Artie's going to be
That's
the
after
person.
8 months.
This is after 8 months.
Yeah.
8 or 9 months of being on the show.
Were you friends with Artie?
Yeah. Artie and I always got along, and... It was actually weird to be in something of a competition with somebody who you liked.
Right.
You know?
And what's going on with you and Mitch? Mitch is on the road all the time at this point, right? So I imagine as a roommate, he was mostly gone, right?
Well, I was only with him for a few months. That was like when I first moved in. And then the stories about Mitch started getting, especially right at that time when he got all the money, he moved into the Chelsea Hotel.
Right.
And that's when the story started getting weird. And I'd go, Mitch? And they'd go, yeah, I heard Mitch is.
Strung out?
I'd be like, no. Because I'd only drank with Mitch and occasionally done coke with Mitch.
Right.
I never heard or seen heroin.
I think he hid that shit.
Yeah.
Because I hung out and done coke with him, but I didn't, you know, I didn't know how deep in he was. That's all it is.
Yeah, and I hadn't, occasionally, it's funny, as a drug addict, to call another drug addict and go, hey man, you doing okay over there?
Yeah.
And he'd go,
what are you up to?
Man, I'm doing all right, man. How you been?
Yeah.
Are you sure you're okay?
Because that's our line. I mean, if you're not crossing the heroin line, then everything's cool.
Yeah,
and you're still doing coke. You're drinking. Okay, anything else going on? You've been up for 3 days. All right, that's cool. But what, anything else?
You're just snorting coke, for a few days and having some heart problems, no heroin.
No heroin, because we got rules here.
Yeah, I don't want you to be an addict. So when Artie got the job, they said, hey, the door is open.
Right.
You can come in anytime you want. But I was so exhausted at that point that I just kind of...
Were you doing coke at that point again?
Yeah, I was doing coke. I did coke all night and slept through the show. I actually slept through the show.
In the studio?
In the studio.
They let you sleep?
No, they made fun of me.
Like, right, that's what I mean.
I was in Philly over the weekend doing a show at the Comedy Cabaret. Somebody showed up with a bunch of coke, and I just kept going through Saturday and Sunday.
Ugh.
And then showed up on Monday morning having not slept, and I thought, oh, man, you know what? We get these long breaks, like these 15, 20-minute commercial breaks.
I'll just take a little.
And then I woke up with the whole country listening to me snoring on the show. Yeah. That ended up happening again later with Artie, and they made material out of it with Artie. Yeah. But Howard was pissed.
Yeah.
And that, it felt like a nail in my coffin.
Because he's not a drug guy.
He's not a drug guy.
Well, the weird thing people don't understand I don't think people understand what it means to, when you're up for 3 days on fucking blow, I think a lot of people are like, what are you doing? It's like, that's a really good question. We're just talking to some idiot. Usually, you're just talking to an idiot.
Well, you're wired wrong. Like, when I had my heart attack, I ended up in the hospital for a week.
What the fuck happened, man?
I was up for several days, and I just stopped breathing. And
You were sitting there, and you're like, I'm not breathing.
There was a buddy of mine. I was at his place, and I knocked on his door. It's like 8 o'clock in the morning. I said, hey, man, I got a problem, I think. I'm not breathing. And he said, let's go to the hospital. And went to the hospital, and then they did all these tests.
Were you jacked?
Yeah, I was. Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, I was in bad shape. And
What do you mean? What happened?
I'm just thinking about how I would feel these heart palpitations, and I'd be like, holy shit, what is that? I better do another line.
Yeah.
And I just kept doing lines.
Yeah.
And
like a flutter? I get those occasionally now.
Yeah. But then my chest is getting tighter. Yeah. And that's something I've never experienced before, and I'm having trouble breathing. And I go to the hospital, and they run all these tests, and then I hear them yelling for a cardiologist. We need a cardiologist ASAP. And I go, well, what's going on? They said, your enzyme levels are supposed to be this. They're, 20 times that. And I said, okay, well, what does that mean? And they said, you're having a heart attack. And then I started crying because I don't know, I never heard the word.
Yeah.
What does that mean? Am I dying? Am I dying right now? And, my buddy that's with me, I'm holding his hand and crying.
Yeah.
And they keep me in the hospital for a week. And my trips used to end in cities around the country working at whatever comedy club. My trips used to end on a Sunday morning. I would slowly get all my stuff together.
But you'd been awake. It's the worst feeling in the world.
And
People just left. And you're like, I got to get ready to go.
I still got to, yeah.
And there's like three people you don't know.
Yep.
And, all right, man. We'll see you, man. Yep. You all right? Yeah.
Yeah. And there was this process where I pull all my stuff together in my hotel room.
Yeah.
Then I had to get a hand towel and wet the hand towel, and I'd had to clean all the surfaces of my hotel room. And then I had to take my money out and wash all the blood off my money.
Yeah.
And unroll and then blow dry my money so that they could fold normally instead of rolling up.
Uh-huh.
And then
what were you so paranoid about?
I was always paranoid that the coke that was left on all the surfaces would be seen by the maids, and the maids would contact the police. And,
oh, okay. So it was the cops.
Yeah, it was the cops, or maybe at the airport they'd see rolled up money and give me a search.
Sure.
And so now my trip ends in a hospital where I'm given my clothes back, and I have to give them the hospital gown I've been in.
And for a week?
Yeah, I was there for a week.
And so you're sitting there with your friend holding his hand, you're crying because... This was really, like, you'd gone too far.
I've gone way too far.
Like, and you always know that when you'd already been sober. So you knew all along that it wasn't going to end well. But for some reason, I don't know why we think we're going to cheat death. But then when all of a sudden it comes, it must be just horrifying. Like, just sort of like, you're like a child. Like, what?
You know you're doing something wrong this whole time.
Yeah.
And then when you get caught is when it really hits home. Like, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And it's getting caught that you suddenly, you go, I know. I'm sorry. I get released from the hospital, coincidentally, and it was the day that my return trip back to New York was.
Yeah.
So I actually still have...
Where were you?
I was in Seattle. I was gonna surprise my friends and show up at a Christmas party in Seattle, and I ended up in the hospital. So all my friends who I was going to surprise came to visit me in the hospital. There was a lot of tears.
How bad was the heart attack? I mean, did you need surgery or?
No, but I ended up with pericarditis, which was the inflammation of the sac of the heart.
Does that go away, or is that with you?
It the discomfort went away, but I damaged my heart, and so
from blow,
yeah. So after this whole week of realizing that I'm wrong and knowing, like, all right, this is it. I got 5 hours to kill, and I go out to spend time with friends. Just still more crying, and we want to see you live. I want to live, and I get in my car. The sun's going down. I got a red eye back to New York, and I thought, well, what am I going to do now? I got a couple hours here. You know what? I'll go downtown. You know what? I'll go back to the Comedy Underground and have a beer. I mean, this has been a rough week. And I said, oh, you know what would be great? You know what would be really great right now after the week that I've had? If I could have a little bit of blow, like not enough to kill me or have another heart attack, but just like a couple beers and like a bump.
Yeah.
Oh, that would. And then, and for the first time in my life, a voice came on in my head that said, there's something really, really wrong with you. And I was scared straight for a year and 2 weeks until I got in a relationship with this awful, awful girl who was begging me to do coke with her. She was like hot.
Now, were you doing the thing for a year? I mean, were you?
Yeah, no, I wasn't.
Turkey. You were just scared. Yeah, you were just like, you heard
straight.
The voice, and that
yeah.
was that.
Scared straight, and
no
little,
drinking or nothing.
No drinking, nothing. No, and for the first time in my life, I realized I got to stop everything,
right?
Because everything leads back to this.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah.
And so I was scared straight, and then I ended up with this girl that who was just someone who I just thought was so beautiful and so hot, and she was begging me to do coke with her, knowing that I had the heart attack. And we got in a big fight one night, and I was like, fuck it. And I started doing coke again for 11 and a half months and until the 2-year anniversary of my heart attack. And the greatest thing that's ever happened to me, yeah. I'm at a metal school performance. The band became Steel Panther.
Uh-huh.
I'm at a Steel Panther show at the Roxy, and it's now December 14th, the anniversary of my heart attack.
Yeah.
And I'm not fucked up. I'm not really partying too hard that night. I'm not doing any coke. I just have a beer in my hand. And I hit the lottery. A light switch came on, and I said, I'm killing myself. And I threw the beer out, and I was like, that's it. And that was it. And it's like,
this is the second time the voice talked to you.
Yeah. And, yeah.
The first time I was like, are you out of your mind?
Yeah. And the thing that's cool is that when you think you're going to be alone, because it's like, oh, I'm so flawed. Yeah. I'm so, outside of society. I'm not a normal person.
Yeah.
The thing that's cool is to go down that road and admit it and just say, I'm going to fucking die if I keep treating myself like this.
Yeah.
And to find out that that there's tons of comics. There's tons of people in the business that you work in all aspects of this business, who are there too. And it opened my eyes up. I didn't realize how many people were not partying like I was. I thought everyone was partying like I was.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's like if you survive that, you know, the only hope you have in a lot of ways is getting clean, because you're not gonna make it. And after a certain age, the regular people don't want to hang out with you. That's always where, you know what I mean?
True.
You're only gonna hang out with these fucking idiots you've decided everybody is like. I remember one time I was with at the Comedy Store in the late 80s, where some chick came to visit me. You know, for the weekend, a girl I went to college with, and we were doing fucking 2-3 nighters, just like drinking and holing up in a house and fucking playing guitar and doing blow and stuff. And she's hanging out there watching all this. And at some point I turned to her, it's like, you know, no one lives like this, man. This is it, man. This is it. And then she wrote me a letter like weeks later saying like, no one would want to. And I'm like, what? I mean, I couldn't even understand it. You know, I couldn't understand it. Like, what are you talking about? We're the winners. But yeah,
you said something once. I don't remember where it was or what whose show it was on. But you said something once that really scared me.
Yeah,
you said, "I always believed in my head that when the drugs got to a point where I was becoming psychotic, that I would stop."
Yeah,
but it never dawned on you that you would never know that you were psychotic.
Yeah, right.
And that was like, I had never even thought of that thought.
Right.
Until you said it, and I thought, "Holy shit!" That, because there are people who along the way.
Oh yeah,
that I've known that have no idea what we're all thinking about them.
Well, that's the weird thing is, like, you can't fix a bad brain with the brain
That, yeah.
You know, like, in that like, hearing it framed that way, that only happened to me recently. It's like, you know, it's like, I got this. No, you don't. how is the same thing that you're fucked up with going to get it?
Yeah.
It's a very tricky thing with the denial business and the delusion that comes from that. You know, like, come on, everyone's like this.
Yeah, it bummed me out because the first year after I had that epiphany, like, all right, I'm dying.
Yeah.
And I need to stop.
Yeah.
And I really need to stop. Tell me what I need. I don't give a fuck. Anybody. I'm open to suggestions. Tell me how to stop. 7 of my friends, all comedians,
yeah,
died that first year.
Yeah. Wait, that, like, 9 years ago?
9 years ago, yep. Mitch was the first one to go.
Mm-hmm.
And
then who?
And then there was a guy who Kelly Moran, died that year.
But not from drugs.
That was my understanding, was that
the piano
prescription
player?
Yeah.
Oh,
prescription,
really?
Pills.
Oh, yeah. I remember, vaguely remember that. Yeah. Who else?
A friend of mine that I went to high school, a really tragic story. A guy that I went to high school with, whose name was Brian Corrigan. He had become an open micer. Mm. When we were in high school, Brian Corrigan was drunk and took his parents' car out for a joyride, flipped it, and paralyzed himself and his best friend. So you would see these two together that you always saw together hanging out. Now they're both hanging out together all the time in wheelchairs. And then 20 years later...
Oh, I heard about this. He killed himself?
Well, he's doing stand-up comedy now in Tucson. He's working at Laughs, and he loves doing stand-up. And they're all partying at Laughs one night. Yeah. Like, hey, let's take it to the bartender's house.
Yeah.
So they all jump in the cars. Brian has one of those cars that you can operate with your hand.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's driving through an intersection at 35 miles an hour, going through a green light. And a guy who had just robbed a 7-Eleven that was also drunk was going through the red light at 70 miles an hour and hit him and T-boned him. So, so
did you write about that online or something, or did you?
Yeah, I've written about that, and I've also once a year, that'll be the only personal thing that I'll write, is when I get another year.
I remember, yeah.
I'll say, hey, you know, I'll just say, if you need help, this is only going to resonate with you if you need help. If you need help, I did it. You have to love yourself, and then you can be free. And that's the only personal thing I'll put on. And it's very tough for me to click post on that because that's so personal.
Yeah.
And the feedback that I'll get from that is the most intense of anything I'll put all year long.
Yeah, I hear it a lot myself. It's just that, you know, people need to hear it. I don't know what the hell it is.
So you don't want to say it? You're
afraid? No, I do say it. Sure. Okay. There's help on the way. There's help available. There's help always there. You know, if you're willing to reach out and ask for it, you know, and it just, I think that everybody, especially people who are involved in that, you know, very stubborn, and you know, there's some part of them that wants to protect their ability to do it.
Yeah,
you know,
that's what keeps us going in that circle is that there's this, you know, man, fuck, something's wrong, I need help, and so you start dipping into getting help, and then you look around, and you go, I'll figure it out, okay.
I don't want to be one of you people.
Yeah, I don't want to be one. And that's from the very beginning. It was like, man, these people are fucked up.
Yeah.
And then a couple years later, I come back. All right, maybe I need to listen a little more. And I go, all right, you know what? That guy,
he's all right.
I get him, and that guy's all right. But the rest of these people are. Yeah, I'm out of here.
Yeah, I'll hang out with them.
And then come back, and I find myself relating more and more to people until I had to just swallow my pride so much. I had to go, all right, you know, just, and there's nothing better than arriving at a moment where you go, just tell me what I need to do. I don't give a fuck what you, I'm listening to you. I just don't want to live like this.
Yeah.
And, I can't tell you how much of a joy it is to be able to travel around the country. And I remember you had a thing that you did once on Conan.
Yeah.
I think I've seen you do this a couple times about how the demons used to be.
Oh yeah,
coke,
yeah,
blah blah.
Yeah, ice cream. Yeah,
yeah. All right, how about some ice cream, some porn, and it's funny how I ended up on that path. Like, you know,
sure.
Like wow, you know, and I still have intensity about, like, you know, things that I've always loved, like chocolate milk.
Sure.
You know.
Yeah.
And then I'll find myself now. I'll check out of a hotel. And I'll look down the hall and I'll see the maid's in the next room.
Yeah.
She's coming to my room next.
Yeah.
And I'll look back in my room and I go, should I clean this up? Because there's like 10, 12 empty chocolate milk cartons in my room. And it looks like I had a party for a bunch of 8-year-olds in my room. And I'm like, oh, this looks weird. This looks really weird. And then I'll be kind of embarrassed. But it's so much better than crying and being completely demoralized on a plane thinking, like, what the hell is wrong with me, you know?
Well, congratulations on the chocolate milk thing.
Yeah. I still have a lot of love for these little things in life. And I'm glad you had me on. And I was just looking forward to just connecting with you. So thank you.
I think we did all right.
Thank you for having me on, Mark.
Yeah, it was great talking to you. That's it. That is the show. I love that guy, Kennison. Having known Sam, it gave me flashbacks. But I hope you enjoyed that. Thank you for listening. I love you. Go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF Pod stuff. Get the free app. Upgrade. You can stream all of them. All of them. I just said that like a New Yorker. What else? Leave comments. Do whatever you want, man. Check the calendar. Check the schedule. I'm at Mark Maron on Twitter with a C. Well, I've never said that before. Does that matter? Oh God. Okay. Boomer lives!
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.